This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. You know about Montpelier, right? Ancestral home of our fourth president and America's original activist first lady, James and Dolly Madison. But how much else do you know about it? The museum that documents life in the South during the early 1800s? The growing number of festivals that take place there each year? The story of the freed slave who became a published author? The Center for the Constitution, that's now a resource for burgeoning democracies around the world. If you've never been to Montpelier, or haven't been in a while, you're probably going to be surprised at what now transpires on the 2,700-acre campus in Orange County. Two of the leaders of the Montpelier Foundation are here to fill us in, both on some history you likely never learned in school, and the promise for a future even the father of the U.S. Constitution may never have imagined. It's all coming up right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Two of the leaders of the Montpelier Foundation are with us, and our call-in number is easy to remember as 888-WMRA-TALK. Got questions, thoughts, insights about James Madison? Dolly Madison, the Center for the Constitution, or anything else, Montpelier? Here with me in the Insight Studio, the director of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at Montpelier, as well as vice president of the Montpelier Foundation, Doug Smith, plus Doug's boss and president of that Montpelier Foundation, Catherine Cat Imhoff. Thank you both for making time for us.
Thanks, Tom.
Tom, we're so excited to be here and in the town of James Madison University.
Well, Kat, I want to ask you, if you could, to pretend for a moment that I have never spent time in Virginia and don't remember much at all about U.S. history. And now that you've got those understandings about me, please tell me about Montpelier.
I would be thrilled to do so. And you're not, this is not an uncommon problem among the American public. But so let's just paint a picture. Montpelier is a real place, and it is located on Route 20 south of the town of Orange, just 4 miles and 21 miles north of Charlottesville. This is also known as the Journey Through Hallowed Ground, in case any of your visitors think about this landscape that connects Gettysburg to Monticello. And Montpelier is the lifelong home of James Madison, James and Dolly Madison. But this is where we have what you would anticipate, or you could, if you were to roll on the road, you would see the gates and you would enter in to a now 2,700-acre plantation. It has rolling fields. It has forests. It has, in fact, an old-growth forest that you can take a hike through. And you would see then the house, the mansion, the home of James Madison that was restored in 2008. And like most house museums, we would invite you to come have a visit, step through the doors and see the parlor, the libraries, the places where James Madison dined with guests that included his friend Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, where Dolly Madison entertained at times up to 100 people in the back lawn. But that would just be part of the experience if you were this new, brand new visitor to James Madison's Montpelier. You would also have a chance to learn more about the history of slavery in this country. We have ghosted buildings. We also
ghosted buildings?
So you'd see the outlines of original slave dwellings. And what really strikes people when they visit Montpelier is both the grandeur of the views looking out over the Blue Ridge, gorgeous, but also how it was really a working community, that there was a large slave population and slave population that made Montpelier work. And we tell that story as well. So we would see some of those structures in some portion of being recreated. You would also be able to visit the James Madison Cemetery, the Family Cemetery, and the Slave Cemetery. And what I think makes Montpelier intriguing, in addition to this founding father, the father of the Constitution, the architect of the Bill of Rights, Dolly Madison, known as America's first lady, we also can talk about a much broader range of American history than sometimes happens at other historic homes, because we have the Gilmore Cabin, which is a freed black man cabin, George Gilmore. We can talk a little bit more about him. We were the site of the Civil War, went back and forth over the property. So we have a whole section which has Civil War encampments and interpretation. And finally, as you think about how citizenship has changed in the United States since the time of James Madison. We have a train depot right there on Route 20. It's going to be the first thing that captures your eye, bringing this journey all the way back around. And it was built in 1910 as a segregated train station, and you can learn more about the period of Jim Crow. So Montpelier is a rich visitor experience. That's one way to look at it. So I'd like to kind of hand answering that question also over to my colleague, Doug, because as well as being a power of the place, we have the power of ideas.
Thanks, Kat. Tom, your question is a great one. And like Kat said, we have a lot of people that they may not have heard of Montpelier, and they may have just a tangential reminder occasionally or memory of Madison himself. You know, was one of the main drafters of the Constitution. We say father of the Constitution. But it really, as Kat says, it is this power of ideas as well. I mean, the house itself sits on the top of a hill, and you overlook this beautiful sweeping vista view of the Blue Ridge. And you can imagine that, you know, James Madison himself is up there, and he's thinking not just about the current colonies, but he knows there's more to the West. And he's got to develop a system that works, because in the time of Madison, the system simply didn't work. And so he studied ardently and developed these ideas and ideals that ultimately made their way into our U.S. Constitution. And in many ways, Montpelier is still a place where that happens. We do that with domestic and international audiences. We do it with teachers and law enforcement agencies and elected officials from all over the world. We're a place where domestically and internationally, people are convening and congregating to learn more about the foundations, not just of U.S. government, but really what's good governance? What makes it work around the world? You have to have the rule of law. What can federalism look like? How lucky we are to live in the kind of America where we can amend our Constitution and be sure that there's a very clear process for doing that, where we don't have to worry about bloodshed. I mean, that's one of the amazing things that Madison and those other leaders at the Constitutional Convention have given to us. And so Montpelier really is a place where the power of ideas is centralized, is brought together with audiences from all over the world, particularly domestically, and how we then can help others to carry that through in their everyday life. If you're a member of the law enforcement community and you're taking an oath to U.S. Constitution, I'm pretty sure I want you to have read it. And what I'd really like for you to do is to understand it as well.
Doug Smith from Montpelier, some people hearing that there is a center for the Constitution at Montpelier might conclude that, oh, this is a nice place where you go and get to see copies of the Constitution or maybe pictures of the framers of the Constitution. That's really not it.
It's not it. No, you know, what we've done since 2003 is we've worked with over 31,000 people across the world, over 60 countries, every state in the nation. And we've developed a model of residential and online coursework. Some of that coursework is actually in partnership with JMU, James Madison University, which we love. But in addition to that,
it has nothing to do with you being a JMU alumni, then.
Okay.
Oh, he's so outed.
You know, I didn't want to say go Dukes so early.
But the Center for the Constitution is a place where people come from the U.S., largely in law enforcement, to learn more about the U.S. Constitution from other places in the world, to both examine the U.S. Constitution and to discuss how different types of constitutions might work in different places in the world. Do I have that correct?
You know, it's close. So we have teachers coming in, law enforcement. We have elected officials. We have judges. We have members of the media. It's really, for us, we're looking for as many people as we can touch, and we serve as almost an executive training center. You know, we are a place where people come and they don't learn, you know, how to teach the Constitution. There's lots of organizations that are really great organizations doing kind of civic lessoning. What we do is we help people to understand the philosophy and the frameworks behind the Constitution. You know, not just what does the First Amendment say, but why do we have a First Amendment and why is that so important as part of our American ethos? And when people come and they learn about that, then the application of the Constitution becomes more real. It becomes more possible for them to uphold that, to honor that, and really to push that through their everyday professional life. We're really working with adult professionals. Lots of groups are doing K through 12, and that's fantastic. But we choose to work with adult professionals because we think that's one of the levers in society that we can have the biggest impact through.
But I don't want to forget that we still have 125,000 regular visitors coming through our gates, and they also have the opportunity to benefit from all that because we pull it into our tours. So I love the fact that Montpelier is definitely a house museum, but it's a house museum with so much more, and that's what makes it exciting because it's really relevant today. We're not just looking backwards, but we're really thinking about the future.
That's right. You know, we have. You would expect to come to Montpelier as a historic site, and you would expect to get a tour of the house and to hear a lot about the Madisons and the enslaved community and what it was like running the house. But I'm really proud. I mean, one of the things I love about being a Montpelier cat is that we have this Constitution tour. We have a tour on the enslaved community, a tour on women and Montpelier. I mean, that's really where the substance is. And I think that distinguishes us from a lot of different sites, to be honest with you.
It has been very interesting because we are also part of, we had this program this summer with young emerging leaders from Sub-Sahara Africa, and that was part of the presidential precinct. I've joked around that we're part of the Napa Valley of History. So when you asked earlier where we are, well, we're in the Napa Valley of History. We're lucky that we're working with sites like Monticello and Ashland Highland, but also University of Virginia and William and Mary, of really providing all Americans and international visitors with a really rich experience in Central Virginia.
Yeah. Kat Imhoff is president of the Montpelier Foundation. Doug Smith is vice president, as well as director of the Center for the Constitution at Montpelier. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. I love when I get to reveal my ignorance. Who was James Madison?
Who was James Madison? Come on, Tom. You had civics, didn't you? Father of the Constitution, primary author of the Bill of Rights. He was our fourth president. He served as Secretary of State under Thomas Jefferson. Interestingly, never left the country, though.
Why was he called the Father of the Constitution?
You know, he was probably the intellectual firepower in the room. There were a lot of very smart people at the Constitutional Convention. It's that summer of 1787. A lot of important, smart people in the room. But he was the intellectual firepower at the Constitutional Convention that was deeply involved with not just recording what was happening.
Oh, but I got to back you up.
Yeah.
So, I mean, why James Madison matters is so we always think of the Declaration of Independence. Yay, we became an independent country. But then it didn't work. We completely ignore, most of us, the Articles of Confederation.
But let's back up even further if we could. I mean, if we want to talk about who James Madison was, he was a contemporary of Thomas Jefferson.
He was
what, 7 or 8 years younger than Jefferson?
He was.
He was serving in the Virginia General Assembly.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was the son of a rich man. His father was named James Madison. So he's James Madison Jr.
He was one of the youngest ever legislators, at least of his time.
He was. His grandfather settled what is Montpelier, Ambrose Madison. And so he grew up in privilege, and he grew up in a wealthy Virginia family. And from early on, I think his brilliance was recognized. He was the oldest of his family, and they had tutors. And he, interestingly enough, unlike his contemporaries like Thomas Jefferson, he goes to the College of New Jersey, today's Princeton, and at that point, a hotbed of radicalism, of really fermenting this ideas out of the Enlightenment and this interest in seeing the country think about its independence differently.
And he also studies Latin, which is not unusual for his day, but he studies Hebrew as well?
He is one of the most intelligent men in America, as Jefferson said, and he is well-read. And this is going to be important to us when we talk about how we come to the Virginia Plan and the Constitution.
So all of the different languages that he studied seem to indicate, at least in part, an interest in views around the world. Is that fair?
He was a very free mind, and let's think about what he thought about freedom of conscience as well.
Okay, well, we'll continue with that when we get back here on Virginia Insight with our guests from James Madison's Montpelier after we pause for about a minute. Our guests on this edition of Virginia Insight, Kat Imhoff, the woman in charge of the foundation that runs the museum and all the other departments at the ancestral home of James and Dolly Madison. That home, of course, known simply as Montpelier. Also with us, the Vice President of the Montpelier Foundation and Director of its Center for the Constitution, Doug Smith. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham. We were talking about conscience and James Madison's early days as a state legislator and having something to do with freedom of religion, I think, is where we're going.
Yeah, Tom, you asked the question, who is James Madison? And we're sort of fumbling with it because he's so many things and we always kind of fall over ourselves. But I want to pick up the part that has been very interesting to me personally, and is that James Madison is very well read. He is from a wealthy, influential family. But early on in his life, in fact, in his teens, he ends up inserting himself in a situation in Culpeper County, where the Baptists have been imprisoned for preaching their religion. And he rides to Culpeper and really says, I feel that this is so wrong. People have a freedom of conscience. They should have a right to the free expression of their religion. And this becomes a thread. So these wonderful ideas that come from Madison and then get embedded in his development of the Virginia Plan, and I'm going to pass the torch to Doug in a second. But what I find interesting is when you think of Madison, think of a young, well-educated Virginia gentleman who's educated at Princeton, but returns and has a long life of public service. And one of the most important things he does is sit and think about 2,000 years of civilization and why democracies and republics have failed in the past. He takes those ideas forward as a Virginia plan, and he brings them to the convention. So I'm going to hand that to Doug.
Yeah, I love.
And actually,
convention.
The Virginia Plan was the title of the writings that he brought with him to the Constitutional Convention.
So, you know, when people gathered the convention, several of them brought ideas with them, but just to be clear, I don't think anyone thought that they were going to radically change the Articles of Confederation. I mean, Madison really had to work with Washington to convince, the father of our country to even be at the convention. He really had to put the strong arm on him. But when they got there, there were various plans. The most dominant one was, of course, the Virginia Plan that he was the primary author of. And what Madison is trying to do is he's trying to build momentum. He's trying to reform government, and he's trying to build consensus. And those are not easy things to do if you think that every one of our states at that time acted like independent countries. And yet, because he was so prepared when he got there, he could actually make it work. He did the work that he needed in the background, built the kinds of coalitions, and brought that intellectual firepower. Some would say if Washington secured our freedom from England, then Madison is probably most to thank for sustaining our way of American liberty since then. And it's because of the time and the intellect he was able to bring to the table that influenced the convention itself.
Well, and then he spends the rest of his life really protecting the Constitution. Not only do they get the plan adopted as the base of the U.S. Constitution, but then they've got to get it ratified by all the states. And so people often forget, but he's one of the important writers of the Federalist Papers. And he goes on the stump, and they've got to get each of the states to roll out the vote. One of the hardest states to get the final vote in ends up being Virginia, and over issues such as freedom of religion. So some things don't end up originally in the U.S. Constitution. Madison makes the commitment to get the compromises, to get all of this passed, that there will be a Bill of Rights. So, of course, what we oftentimes think about is the things about the right to freedom of religion, freedom of the press, the right to assemble, the right to a trial by jury. All of these are just integral to us as Americans. That is, he also gets those. And then he spends the rest of his life both under, working for Jefferson, working in Congress, a two-term president, and his retirement life at Montpelier. He spends his whole life ensuring that the Constitution stays strong.
One of the things that seems to me to be especially fascinating about Madison is how much his political views evolved over time on some matters and stayed pretty much steady and the same on other matters. So maybe I can ask you some about that, but I want to remind anybody listening that if you want to join this conversation with our guests from Montpelier, Doug Smith and Kat Imhoff, we do have a phone line open at 888-967-2825, or if you prefer to type instead of talk, you can reach us on our Facebook page where we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And this is coming from Mike on our Facebook page, who says, Sometimes today you hear somebody say about a person who is small in stature that they have a Napoleon complex. James Madison was, of course, quite short. And he was a leader in this country at the same time Napoleon was in Europe. Were comparisons ever made between the two?
I love that question. That's the first time I've actually had that question put up. No, I have never answered that, but I do think it's really interesting. And I like how people recently have been saying Madisonian Constitution and using Madison in these phrases. But I must say, I'm always struck by people will describe Madison as frail or sometimes unhealthy. And then you'll read where he rides 23 miles in an ice storm to be at a speech, or that he'll travel on horseback to visit his friend Jefferson at Montpelier, and that's a 24-25 mile ride on horseback. So I think sometimes I'm sure that he was short of stature, but he was large of intellect and I think of great endurance. What do you think, Doug?
I think the word is relentless. he was going to make sure that he wasn't a man that seemed. It seems like he was not a man who always had to get his way, but he wanted there to be a way. He wanted to see momentum. And that was one of the great things that he was able to do. I don't know if it related to his stature at all. He was slight in stature, and he was known to have a lot of sicknesses. But like you're saying, Kat, he was relentless, and he would talk to everyone he had to talk to.
Maybe that's the part where it's not the Napoleon complex, because he is the great compromiser. He builds these friendships. In fact, he uses the White House, he and Dolly, in a very, I think, pivotal way of, rather than keeping factions apart, they put people at the same table. When people have differences of opinion, they'd be invited to that dinner party.
I want to ask you to go into more detail about that. And if I forget, please remind me. But we've had Rick here waiting on the line for a bit. So, Rick, we don't want to make you wait too much longer in Lacey Springs. Rick, thank you for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Kat Imhoff and or Doug Smith, please.
Thank you so much. Either or both. One, very simple. At the time of James, in James Madison's lifetime, would they have pronounced it Montpelier? And the second question is, what was Madison's view about slavery? That's really about it.
Well, one is easy and one is complicated, but thank you, Rick. I'll take a stab at a little bit at both of them. Because it's in Montpelier, of course, is the French town and refers to kind of describing a rolling terrain in French. But as far as I know, partly because they did drop the one L, I think it has been anglicized to Montpelier for a while, though Doug and I both say it slightly differently.
Well, Doug comes from Tidewater.
Yeah.
He pronounces things
correctly, apparently. But on the views of slavery, I believe, and we can see this from the writings of Madison, that Madison always knew that slavery was inherently evil. He writes about it as a young man wanting to have nothing to do with slavery, but he can never see his way out of the conundrum. And towards the end of his life, he is particularly struck by the fact that there doesn't seem to be a good solution. He tries various ideas out, because here's his problem. He believes in individual rights and freedoms, but he also believes in property. And how do you make that transition when people are owned as property? I never see in any of his writings any of that sense of prejudice, or that people who are from African-American descent were less than human or less than him. But he could not find a way to kind of disengage. And he's, I really believe, in his final days at Montpelier, we know he is very torn and sees that as the great dilemma of the going to face the nation. And of course we do with the Civil War.
As one of the co-writers of the Constitution, was he, if not the originator, at least a supporter of the so-called three-fifths compromise, that the South would get its population measured for purposes of representation in Congress by not only white people being counted, but three-fifths of every slave being counted as a member of the population?
Well, let me actually take the caller's questions and combine those.
Okay.
We know there was one person who came to Montpelier who did call it Montpelier.
Oh, that's right.
And that was the Marquis de Lafayette. The Marquis de Lafayette came back on a little bit of a victory tour, stopped by Montpelier, and he was a strict abolitionist. And so we know that he was really putting a lot of pressure on Madison and his contemporaries to do the right thing here. And so as complicated as the issue is in a 19th century reality, and you know, in a contemporary way, we look back and say, how could that be conflicting? But for Madison, you read his papers and he is conflicted. Well, the Marquis de Lafayette and others were really pushing an abolitionist line, as they should have been. And that wasn't easy for Madison. When he gets to the convention, your question is you know, interesting. You know, well, what did he think about three-fifths? Well, Madison was one of the voices to put in the 20-year clause, for mm-hmm. instance, to make sure that there would be no import of slaves, you know.
20 years after the Constitution
exactly.
was ratified.
So I think that...
And he didn't get his way on that.
Well, what we know is that Madison realizes that there's a problem here, but he still has to stitch up a North-South coalition to fix the Articles of Confederation and to get a constitution passed. And wrong or right, and I think looking back, contemporary people would say wrong. Wrong or right, in that instance, what he ends up doing is he ends up compromising in order to go for the big whole vision that the country is going to be whole, that it's not going to be 13 different countries, but it's going to be a United States.
And he does indeed. He chooses the Union,
yeah.
knowing that this is the compromise to get the Union. And if you think about if there hadn't been a United States of America, if it stayed independent colonies, I often wonder, would we have been able to have the Louisiana Purchase? Would you need a passport to cross over the Mississippi into some Western territory that would not be the United States? But from our viewpoint looking back, it is very hard to comprehend how you could talk about freedoms and not be recognizing the freedoms of this enslaved community.
Yeah, undeniably, they weren't all perfect, and this was a horrific institution, slavery. But they got this together and said, we will kick the ball down the road. And as Kat said, the ball got kicked to the Civil War, and that's where the conflict really came north and south.
Can I talk a little bit about Paul Jennings?
Before
at some point?
You do, yeah. Just for the sake of anybody who's yeah. tuned in recently, let me mention that C. Douglas Smith heads up the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution, based at Montpelier in Orange County, Virginia. Catherine Kat Imhoff is president of Montpelier. This is Virginia Insight. And Kat, before you get to that next item, we do have this question from Sarah on our Facebook page that looks a little bit related to what Rick was talking about. In this case, Sarah is saying, quote, didn't Dolly Madison come from a Quaker family? I thought Quakers were opposed to slavery. Did Dolly ever talk about being against slavery herself?
Great question. And it shows just how much slavery and the ideas of it have changed over time. So, yes, Dolly Madison is born a Quaker, but her family actually are slaveholders. There's a reform within the Quaker movement in the church, and all of the Quakers to remain within the Friends Society must free their slaves. And her father is a devout Quaker, though, come to it. And he does that, and he moves up to Philadelphia and becomes a starch merchant. And their life, which
a
is
starch
merchant.
He sells starch.
He sells starch.
This
and
is
he,
the kind of stuff that you use when you're ironing, or
that's
the things
exactly
you put
right.
in clothes.
Okay, yep, it's okay. what you use, and it does not go well. And so she has had quite a wonderful life in Hanover County, slave supported. She is now living in Philadelphia, and her father's business fails. And actually, he becomes very depressed and goes to bed and never gets back up from the bed. So all of a sudden, her mother is having to run a boarding house. The children are all having to kind of make their way in society. And she stays in the Mormon church, and she marries her first husband. James Madison is her second. She marries a young young Quaker attorney, John Todd. Payne Todd, and she has two children with him. He dies in the yellow fever epidemic, and so does her youngest son on the same day. And so she is suddenly this widow with one child in Philadelphia society, and she is that young, attractive Quaker lady.
And was it Aaron Burr who introduced
yes,
her to
absolutely.
James Madison?
So Aaron Burr knew their family from the boarding house, and Aaron Burr did make the introductions between Dolly and James. Aaron Burr had gone to Princeton with James Madison. And it's a very, it's fairly quick courtship. Dolly writes a friend saying, I'm going to be making the introductions of the great little Mr. Madison. And apparently they were quite smitten with one another. And they have an amazing marriage and partnership. So one of the great first power couples of the United States, James and Dolly. And it all starts there.
So Sarah got the first part in her question right. Dolly does come from a Quaker background. Did Dolly Madison ever speak out against slavery, to our knowledge?
To our knowledge, not. And in fact, when she marries James Madison, she's read out of the Quaker Church and is no longer practicing, though people will talk about she'll sometimes wear some of the accoutrements and hats associated with the Quaker tradition. And she lives, in some ways, a plain life. But she has slaves, and she does not free slaves. With the death of Madison, she inherits Montpelier. It's already been in a 10-year economic agricultural decline throughout Virginia and the South. Her son has also gambled away much of the resources of the plantation, and she ends up residing in Washington, D.C., a place where she'd had a lot of influence and continued to the end of her life. And she does not free any slaves in her lifetime.
A couple other things maybe we should note about Dolly and James Madison. He was significantly older than her. She was in her mid-20s. He was in his early 40s.
That's correct.
And you were about to say, Doug Smith?
Not at all. I was going to say he was 43, and I think she was 25.
Yeah, close enough. We won't. Yeah. That's 26 and 43, I think.
26
is
and 43.
Right. But,
and so Madison dies in the mid-1830s. And she is in her early 60s. He was in his
80s. And when he dies, she is bereft. But she does something very important, which she continues his work on the notes from the Constitutional Convention. So when we say that they were a power couple, they really, from the time that they're married, she is his hostess. She brings the politics of hospitality to Washington, D.C. She serves as a hostess as well for President Jefferson, and she continues Madison's great work and ensures that all of the papers from the Constitutional Convention finally are published. An interesting note, something you could not do today, when they meet in Philadelphia and they compose and make the compromises and have the tough conversations about the U.S. Constitution, it is all in secret session. There is no media there. And James Madison keeps prodigious notes, but they make a pledge that no one will talk about what's happening in the convention, nor share the notes until the last founder has died.
Kat Imhoff is president of the Montpelier Foundation. Doug Smith is vice president of that foundation, as well as director of the Center for the Constitution at Montpelier. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. You can hear the music, meaning we've got to pause for a short break. And Kat, there are a couple of topics that you wanted to get to that I hope we can when we get back from the break. And we probably also ought to ask you to explain why Dolly Madison is thought of as the first lady when her husband was the fourth president. C. Douglas Smith heads up the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution that's based at Montpelier in Orange County, Virginia. Catherine Kat Imhoff is president of the Montpelier Foundation. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. There are some things coming up at specific times at Montpelier. Kat, tell us about those.
Wonderful. Yes, we've got a couple of great events coming up this fall. The one we hope everyone will show up for is September 20th, which is our Constitution Day celebration, as well as our Taste of Freedom Wine Festival. This is from 10 to dark. We'll have fireworks, live music, wine tastings. We'll be featuring two new brews from Devil's Backbone, and it's a great day to celebrate the signing of the U.S. Constitution. We also have the 80th running of the Montpelier Hunt races, and that will be on Saturday, November 1st. And we all know what that's like, but it's a wonderful time to be at Montpelier with the horses, the Jack Russells, the art, the craft, the vendors. Great opportunity. And finally, if as you're planning ahead for December, we'll do our candlelight Christmas tours over two different weekends. You can visit all of this on our website and much more. And of course, always come and walk on the site.
Doug Smith, Why was Dolly Madison thought of as the first lady?
Well, I think it was really a quote from Zachary Taylor. He recognized her as the first lady. But, you know, early on in the founding, the spouse of the president really didn't know what to do. I mean, we didn't even know how to handle the president. You know, Your Excellency, do we bow? Are they on some kind of a plinth? Well, Dolly has this great experience where she essentially is the first lady to Thomas Jefferson. When Jefferson has people coming to Washington in the White House, his wife has passed away, and so he pulls in the service of Dolly Madison. And so by the time Dolly becomes the real first lady for James Madison, she's kind of already been through a bit of practice, and that's been great for her. And so she spends these 8 years with James Madison, and it's just a tremendous experience where he is at times more reserved. She's very outgoing, where he is the one to pull people off to the sides to build compromise. She's the one to grab, you know, two arms and to pull them over for him to actually talk to. She is known to be very gregarious and very popular. People love Dolly Madison. In fact, it's said that at the time of her funeral, when she dies in the mid-19th century, it's actually the largest funeral ever in Washington, D.C. at that time. She is just beloved. And because she has known, I believe, is it 13 presidents that she knows? You know, she knows Washington all the way through Jackson.
And actually meets Lincoln.
And has
met Lincoln.
Of course,
he's not president, but he's a young congressman at that point. What's the wonderful quote when Pinckney ran against James Madison?
Oh, yeah. So in 1812, I believe it was, there's this presidential election.
Madison running for a second term.
Madison running for a second term against Charles Pinckney, who they had already had a bit of a conflict there at the convention anyway. And he said, well, I was beaten by Mr. and Mrs. Madison. I might have had a better chance if it were just Mr. Madison alone.
And I like Andrew Jackson. He says at one point, too, and you can just see Dolly Madison eating this up. He goes, oh, everybody loves Dolly Madison. And she says, because Dolly Madison loves everybody. But she really used her position and her smarts and her social savvy to move the political scene in Washington, D.C. And she remained the great grande dame of D.C. for her life.
Yeah,
next
you think
to
about
Basie, if we could. David, thanks for calling us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Doug Smith and or Kat Imhoff from Montpelier, please.
Yes, if James Madison had lived in the period just before the Civil War, wouldn't he have sided with Stephen Douglas rather than Abraham Lincoln in believing that each state could decide for itself through popular sovereignty whether to be a free or a slave state, because he believed that when each state joined the Union, it came in on an equal footing with all other states?
That's a wonderful question, and I'll give you just my personal take on it. I think that Madison, as you see his writings and his conversations at the end of the life, he's having to have that internal conversation. Do I believe people are property, or do I believe every person has an inherent worth and a right to their life? And I believe personally that he was leaning towards the latter. I think that he would have had to move away from his property sense. And I also think, just knowing how the way trade works across states, it would have been almost impossible to have had some states slaveholders, some states not. It really gets more at this very intrinsic question about what do we mean as human beings and how do we respect each other. So I would vote for he would have not been on the people or property slate.
You know, that's a great question, though. It's so hard to kind of put Madison in a different time and say, what would he have said? I guess I would answer that. You know, my guess is in a Lincoln-Douglas debate, he would actually want to be the moderator. And the reason is because he just honored debate. He thought discourse was really important and was incredibly positive for the fabric of the country. And so I don't know if he would have sided on one side or the other. It's hard to look back and tell, but I'm pretty sure he would have wanted to moderate that, because he'd want it to be a robust debate that considered all sides.
David, what a great question. Thank you so much for calling us. Kat Imhoff, who is Paul Jennings?
Oh, thank you so much for asking me about Paul Jennings. I mean, we have so many different wonderful stories at Montpelier, and if people come, they can do the Women at Montpelier tour, and we talk about some of those stories. But one of the stories that I'm most interested in, and why it's so important, because an anniversary is coming up on August 25th, it's about the burning of the White House. So the British invasion, War of 1812, Dolly is staying at the White House because they cannot really believe the British are going to make it all the way into the Capitol. And she's there with a young slave, Paul Jennings, who was born at Montpelier, follows her and serves them in the White House. And he and others are part of a last-ditch effort, as they now see Washington is going to fall, to remove the portrait of George Washington, cut it down from the wall, as well as secure many of the important papers of the presidency. In fact, Dolly Madison does not save her own jewels or clothing or their personal belongings. They're really loading up the wagons and the carts with the most precious of the federal documents. And Paul Jennings there. He's there for that. Paul Jennings continues to serve Madison and at Montpelier. And in Madison's retirement, he is Madison's servant, manservant in the house, and he is with Madison when he dies. And he's the only person to record Madison's last words, which were, he's asked, you know, oh, what's by her, his niece, what is wrong? Oh, nothing other than a change of mind, my dear. And then he dies. And Paul Jennings described as just like a candle being snuffed out gently. And then Paul Jennings goes on to be sold. When all the debts start accruing to Montpelier, he ends up eventually being purchased by Daniel Webster, who allows Paul Jennings to kind of pay off his purchase price. Of course, Daniel Webster is an abolitionist. And Paul Jennings, he's literate. He's grown up in this, you know, fourth presidential home. He's seen the workings of Washington, D.C. He writes the first memorial, first remembrance of life in the White House, a colored man's reminiscence of the White House. This is why we know so much about that early life. He also goes on to use his literacy to forge papers for slaves that are passing, trying to pass for free and escape slavery. He is part of the Underground Railroad in Washington, D.C. Three of his sons end up fighting on the side of the North. And I'm very proud to say one of his descendants, Margaret Durden, serves on our board at Montpelier. So it is an American life well lived, and it's so exciting. And we have a daguerreotype, so we know what Paul Jennings looks like. And we have a daguerreotype of Dolly Madison, and it is wonderful to have those images. So you can see those online.
Kat Imhoff and Doug Smith, if anybody's been listening for the entire hour, or maybe even just for the past few minutes, just from the enthusiasm in your voices, let alone everything they've been hearing about Montpelier, I got to believe some people are saying to themselves, I really want to go to Montpelier. I can't believe that it's taken this long for me to think that I should do this. But how much is it going to cost me?
Well, you know, you can come on grounds and walk for free. So I just want never that for that to be a barrier. And we do. We've got all kinds of trails and wonderful learning experiences you can have over and over again. But if you would like to come for tours, our signature tour is $18 for adults and $7 for children. And we do have these in-depth tours as well. I think Doug mentioned it earlier in the program, Madison and the Constitution, Slavery at Montpelier, and the Women of Montpelier. And those are $20, still $7 for children. And it's great because you can experience Montpelier over and over again through these different storytelling opportunities. On weekends, we have cooking tents. The Gilmore Cabin is also open on weekends. And again, we have multiple festivals and special opportunities. So please do visit the website to see our whole calendar.
Kat, it's my understanding that part of your personal story has to do with being dragged to Civil War battlefields and museums as a young child in Virginia because your father loved this stuff. But somewhere along the way, there was something about the things your dad used to tell you about the stories of the battles and the men who died there that got you sort of riveted to the concept of the importance of place and how people are shaped by place. Tell us about that.
Well, Tom, I think you've said that so eloquently yourself. I hope my father is indeed listening. I was indeed tortured as a small child, and I remember being dragged with the big gold Chevy driving from Maine to Virginia and standing out in this empty field of corn while my father is very passionately talking about men knew they were going to die. They were writing their names on the small pieces of paper and sticking them into their pockets. And this was the harbinger of the dog tag today. And of course, he's talking about Cold Harbor Battlefield outside of Richmond. And at that point, it did not interest me at all. A swimming pool was of much greater interest. But, you know, it does seep into you. And when you start seeing these important places and you see the stories, the American stories thread together, it does really begin to shape your view of the world. And I think we're so fortunate in Virginia to have so much of our American history here. And it is never dull because it's about people and it's about issues that still resonate today. If you think about all the what's kind of top of the headline, whether it's in Ferguson, Missouri, or it's battles about religious freedom in the Middle East, everything that we're experiencing and talking about at Montpelier is that past to today.
Doug Smith, Vice President of the Montpelier Foundation, as well as head of the Center for the Constitution at Montpelier. If I'm remembering correctly, early in the hour, you said something, Doug, about how the U.S. Constitution is so important as part of the American ethos. Tell me more about that.
Well, you know, our biggest debates, our biggest conflicts internally as a country really come down to the Constitution, and it comes down to interpretation. You know, is it a living document? Are we strict constructionists? One of the things that makes Americans unique is that not only have many of us actually read our Constitution, fortunately, it hasn't changed very much since it was drafted in 1787, but we embody it. We believe it. You know, when we look at these first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, you know, we adhere to that, and we not only stand behind it, but we stand up for it. And I think that's part of the source of nationalism that is part of our ethos. It's part of the fabric of the United States that, you know, you can argue with someone philosophically about what might be a right or not a right or the way the government works or doesn't work. But at the end of the day, because we have this great document, the U.S. Constitution, that we've all born into or bought into, if you're a new American, we will get behind that. And despite the debate, which is actually encouraged by the First Amendment, you know, what government in the world encourages people to speak out against it? Despite the debate, at the end of the day, we still believe that e pluribus unum, that out of the many comes the one, and that we're one country. And I think that's something that very few other countries have. And it's something that we can celebrate. It's something that we should really be thankful for.
Kat Imhoff, president of the Montpelier Foundation. I know that early in 2014 this was being kept secret, but at this point, can we talk about Myanmar for a few minutes?
Absolutely, and I actually will kind of kick that over to Doug because that was a Center for the Constitution program. But I think one of the reasons why Montpelier and James Madison is still so important today is that we become a place where people who are talking about what we the people means and who gets to make the decisions about who governs them. And that was Burma and Myanmar when they had a retreat here this spring.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Our marketing team, I think the Center for the Constitution drives them crazy because we have these events like when the members of parliament from Myanmar came in, and we try not to actually talk about it too much in public until after the fact. But it's amazing that 9 members of the parliament from Myanmar come to the United States, and they're not looking to cut and paste the U.S. Constitution. What they're looking for is some creative thought about how it is that they go about amending their constitution. Now, this is a fairly new constitution, largely drafted by the junta military government. How do they amend that in such a way that allows Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi to actually become president? Hands down, the majority of the country want her to become president. But because of the way the Constitution was written today, it can't be done. And so we would, in this instance, we worked with these members of parliament trying to find a little bit of a trapdoor, a little bit of a loophole that they could exploit in order to change their Constitution to really do the will of the people. And at the end of the day, that's what's most important about international constitutions, is that there's a rule of law and the will of the people is heard and supported.
It's been so fascinating spending time with you. I am so sorry that we are just about out of time. We've got about 30 seconds left. Kat Imhoff, anything about Montpelier that hasn't yet been said or that you want to reemphasize before we have to close out?
I would just say that the home of James and Dolly Madison is a place of the people and that we really want your listenership to come visit. I find it so sad when I will talk to someone and say, oh yeah, I've lived my whole life and I had no idea. Well, now you do. It's just up the road and we hope you will all be part of it.
Off of Route 20 in Orange County, about 20 miles north of Charlottesville, about 4 miles south of the town of Orange, on what is called Constitution Highway.
I was just about to say that. You can find your way easily to Montpelier.
Our guests have been the president of the Montpelier Foundation, Kat Imhoff, plus the foundation's vice president and director of its Center for the Constitution, Doug Smith. Doug, Kat, thank you both so very much for making time for us.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
Virginia Insight's executive producer, Matt Bingay. Dan Easley is our technical director. Associate producers, Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. Podcasts of this program available on the Virginia Insight tab at WMRA.org. When you get to the page for today's broadcast, you will see links to more information about both of our guests and about Montpelier itself. Plus, if you go to the Virginia Insight Facebook page and click like, you'll have access to a whole bunch more information about these broadcasts there as well. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.